spend the money for either the mine ramp or the white field, I think it's called. Anyhow, you're willing to buy these better machines. I presume the majority of people combing the beach are using the less expensive machines. They're finding things that are 3 inches down. You have the ability to find things that are 2 feet down. Therefore, I am guessing it's a good investment for you because you're finding the things that everyone else is missing. Because you're willing to do a little bit more digging, you're willing to go a little more carefully to find the deeper pieces of metal. Is that approximately what's going on here, Tony? WV2C, K2LIW?
That's pretty much it. I'm not saying 2 feet every time, but let's say between a foot and 2 feet is pretty regular for a decent machine and a coin or a ring. I mean, that's really what we're looking for, coins, rings on the beaches, earrings, you know, something that has some value. And I've got lucky at times and mostly not. So it's like working DX, you know, you're lucky and you're not lucky. It's all a numbers game. The more you do it, the more likely you are to find something of value. And it's, you know, a lot of slow, meticulous going up and down the beach. You develop patterns for doing it. You either go along the beach or up and down the beach. It's just different ways of doing it. But low tide is generally when I'm out there and I do the water's edge and a little bit beyond, because people tend to lose things off their fingers and wrist and necks in the waves. So that's my MO. K2RW, Whiskey Victor 2 Charlie.
That's darn good information, Tony. Wow. So when the waves hit them, that's when they lose these things. So you're right at the beach's edge. Of course, the waves are moving that sand around all kinds of ways. Therefore, things can get buried pretty deep. Might have some guesses as to, as the sand moves around, do some things get brought back up to the surface, or does everything tend to sink deeper? Gold, for instance, is pretty heavy. It's heavier than sand, so I'm guessing with very much drifting of the sand, it's going to dig itself a little bit deeper into the ground, and you've got to find it within the first couple of months before it goes really deep, is my guess. If you're willing to tell us, and it's your choice, what's your favorite beach, and roughly what do you believe is the most valuable thing you have found so far? Because I think there's some people out there sitting on the threshold of should they spend the extra money to buy a really good metal detector. WV2C, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, favorite beaches? I'll go anywhere from Smith Point to Long Beach. So I do the South Shore of Long Island exclusively, mostly Jones Beach, Robin Moses, Long Beach. Those are the closest ones to me. I'm near Glen Cove, so that works out best for me. And I'm sorry, the other question?
Roughly, what was the most valuable thing you found to date, if you're willing to tell us, Tony?
I found a gold chain with a medallion on the end of it, which is nice. It's nice heavy gold, and it traded in value for that, meaning I brought it to a place that buys gold, a wholesale place, and that was worth about $600 to me. That's about the best, but, you know, I found gold wedding bands. People found more expensive things. It's, you know, it's luck. And the season is all year round, but the more people on the beach, the more likely you are to find something. And the longer it's there, the more likely it is to disappear. And gold is heavier, so that'll tend to sink. Coins you find day in and day out, nickels, dimes, quarters, pennies. It's just, you know, pocket change. So you can go out on a day and find 20 cents, and you can go out on a day and find 10 bucks. It's just the way it goes. After a hurricane, it's particularly fun because there's just tons of objects there that are pretty close to the surface because of the turbulence of the waves and draining the sand off the beach. So it's fun. Mine Lab, M-I-N-E-L-A-B, Whites, W-H-I-T-E-S, are two companies. You can Google them. There are also a number of retail places here on Long Island, Treasures Unlimited in Belmore. Sells the stuff and you can play with it firsthand. Let me drop it. If you want to look at Everything Everywhere, Kelly Co. out of Florida, KellyCo. They have everything as well, but I would buy locally for Treasures Unlimited. That's my own personal opinion. But if you want to see everything, Kelly Co. is a good place to start. It's like the AES of metal detecting. K2RW, WV2C, and I don't want to monopolize it, so back over to you.
Don't worry about monopolizing it, Tony. This is a brand new subject we have never explored, and ham radio operators are interested in all kinds of crazy subjects, so we've had a good one here. And this is a brand new field to most of us. You told us Kelly Co. in Florida and Treasures Unlimited in Belmore, I think it was, are some of the local dealers selling this kind of material. Your very best day, did you fill up a small bucket with the things that you found? Was it right after a storm? On top of that, we ham radio operators know where there's a whole lot of clubs that get together and meet once a month. Among the people who do beachcombing for metallic objects, my guess is as you're walking up until years, you probably run into old friends over and over again. Is there a local club of people who meet and trade war stories? So those two subjects now is your... how big was your bucket on your very best day, and are there clubs and are there guys that you keep running into over and over on the beach? WV2C, K2LAW, you got it, Tony.
Okay, well, not a bucket, not even close to that. More like a pouch. Kind of those little fanny bags you tie around your waist. A full one of those is a good day. That's very rare. But one that comes to mind was after a hurricane a few years ago in September. I was at Jones Beach, and there was just one after another. It got to a point where I was just listening for certain tones, because that was the best tone for your chances of getting some jewelry instead of just, you know, coins. But few and far between, I got to just add that not everybody is smart enough to leave the jewelry at home. Most people do leave it at home, is what I'm saying. And clubs, write this down, Atlantic Treasure Club. You can Google that. We meet once a month every Wednesday. We just had our meeting last Wednesday, and the next one's a month away from that, you know, middle of August, and it'll be at Jones Beach in August, and we meet in Wausau on a monthly basis, Atlantic Treasure Club. And there's one out in Suffolk. I'm not familiar with that because I don't go to it, but we run into, you know, members on the beach quite regularly. Go ahead.
Now, what's special about a hurricane? Is it because it moved a whole lot of sand and therefore things that previously were very, very deep now are closer to the surface? Why should after a major hurricane you have such good luck, Paul? Go ahead.
You hit it right on the nose, right on the head there. The hurricanes with the wave action tends to disperse the sand, and what was once 2 or 3 feet down is now pretty much on the surface. A lot of it gets washed away, but a lot of it stays because the waves come up higher on the beach, wash the sand away, and leaves the heavier objects there close to the surface. And that's the way that works.
Very fine, Tony. Sorry I called you the wrong name. Well done. These meetings of the Atlantic Treasure Club on Wednesday, is it a meeting of 3 people or 30 people? How big is that club? Is it expanding, contracting? Give us some words. Has it been around for more than 5 years? WV2C, K2LAW, you got that, Tony.
I believe it's been around for 20 years. It was almost bye-bye about 8 years ago, and since then it's been building, and a typical club meeting will have anywhere from 30 to 40 people. Sometimes with guest speakers, sometimes not. But Google it. Atlantic Treasure Club is a website there. It's fairly new, so there's not a lot of info, but just enough to get you started. And for those in Suffolk County, there's one in the Patch Choke area, I believe. I don't recall the exact name of it. But again, if you Google that, you'll find it.
Well, thank you an awful lot, Tony. This is brand new information for us. But there are curious people out there in both the electronics, home brewing maybe, buying if they got the money to do it. And there's all kinds of fishing. There are people who go out there and fish for, sailfish or swordfish or deep sea fishing. There are guys who like freshwater fishing and real light line. There are guys who like fishing for DX stations with light equipment, heavy equipment. There are microwave enthusiasts that look for those weak signals far away on mountaintops and so on. There's all kinds of fishing. And this is a kind of treasure hunting fishing, call what you like. This is one that the TechNet has, of the 29 years of the TechNet, I don't think we've ever really had a discussion on metal detecting. And Jim, KD2BHY, brought it up tonight. I don't think he has the ability to get into this particular repeater. So he's not going to be able to answer us immediately until a little bit later on if he's still around. I think you, John, KC2WGB, I believe you can get into this repeater. And if you can, we're going to take you right now for the questions from the mailbag. And after that, we're going to go over to Paul, WS2N, in that order. So before it gets too late, let's go to the mailbag, assuming that you can get into this repeater tonight, John. KC2WGB. On 975-375-K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB, 975, how do you copy that?
Loud and clear. Please proceed.
Okay, very good. Good evening to everyone on the net. And we've got thunderstorms brewing right here over Staten Island. All right, first question, sitting by Bill. The question on waveguide. He wants to know what is involved with the skin effect on waveguide. He's not sure if it even has skin effect, but he knows they coat them, and he wants to know how it works and what the detriments of that skin effect applies to a waveguide. He understands the wires, but not waveguide. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. You sound good on this repeater. You could use a little bit more radio. Speak a little bit closer to the mic if you can. I'll give you an example. This is about what you sound. When I turned off my speech processor, or turned the speech processor back on, you can see what the difference is like on this particular Kenwood 711. Every piece of metal, whether it be round, square, flat, rectangular, whatever, displays the RF skin effect. At the molecular level, it's not so easy to explain what's really happening, but take my word for it. There is a formula you can go to. If you Google the word skin effect, you'll find a formula which has got a 1 over square root function in it, and inside that square root function is the mu and the conductivity of the materials. But so it's and there's also frequencies in there. It's a function of 1 over the square root of frequency. The bottom line is that as you go to higher and higher frequencies, the RF energy penetrates a smaller and smaller distance into the copper or brass or whatever your metal is, whether it be waveguide, the semiconductor or the coax, the outer conductor of the coax, doesn't matter. So skin effect is a function of the kind of metal and the frequency you're operating at. As such, when you go to higher frequencies where the skin effect is a smaller and smaller number, just to give you a little bit of a rough feeling for what's going on, at most of the frequencies we operate on, like say for instance 2 meters and 432, the actual depth that the RF energy goes is about 1/10,000th of an inch. In other words, 4 zeros and a 1 of an inch, 1/10,000th of an inch, is the approximate depth of the penetration where the signal is down to 37% of the current density you would have on the surface. The bottom line of that is that what you think is real good copper or silver plated or brass or whatever conductor, gold plated, what you think is a real good conductor develops what looks like more and more resistance when you go to higher and higher frequencies because the skin effect is getting less and less. The skin depth where the RF goes is getting less and less. As such, if you were building coax cable for, say, for instance, a microwave frequency, and you're building a very large diameter complex because you want very low loss, it would give you a funny feeling to make the center conductor out of a thin piece of copper tubing as opposed to a solid piece of copper. If you were putting a B-plus voltage to run a power supply at the far end of the cable, then yes, you would be tempted to use a solid chunk of copper for the center conductor. But if it's only microwave frequencies you're sending down the cable, you might as well use just a thin layer of copper for the center conductor, and anything else in the center is a waste of time. The RF doesn't go there. As such, you can choose whatever you like for the center conductor and just give it a small coating of copper on the outside. There are many kinds of cable where, in order to make the cable less expensive and to make it less heavy, they will make a center conductor out of aluminum with a thin layer of copper coating on top. Of course, there's some kind of other material in between because aluminum and copper are not compatible metals. So there's probably a rhodium flashing or a nickel flashing. There's some other material. And let me give you another example. To take a copper piece of wire and plate it with gold because you want it to have real good conductivity and you don't want it to build up copper oxide. And you tend to do that, for instance, on edge connector type printed circuit boards. Quite often they are, what's the word I'm looking for? Quite often they are gold plated in order to have the copper.
One mode of operation. So because the waveguide is getting smaller,
It has excess loss as you go to higher frequency. Because of the skin effect, it has excess loss as you go to higher frequencies. Because of the skin effect, is a function of 1 over square root of frequency. So you're using less of the copper or silver plating or whatever it is. Don't be discouraged by that. WaveGuide is very good stuff, but there's a catch. And that is, there's a number of situations where people have used 30 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet, and in rare cases, 200 feet of waveguide. My rough rule of thumb is that if you're using more than 200 or 300 feet of waveguide, you should consider another method of operation, like a so-called periscope antenna system. Waveguide, just like coax cable, rarely will you set up a coax cable on a tower situation where you use more than 200 or 300 feet of it. On paper, you would think 1,000 feet of coax cable, if you're willing to afford it, because your tower is going to be on top of the mountain, and the mountain's 1,000 feet away from the shack, you would think 1,000 feet of coax cable is a very tempted way to go. You actually calculate the real insertion loss of the waveguide, called the coax cable, and 1,000 feet of it, and you'll find the number is so big that only a couple of percent of your power gets into the far end of the cable. And that's not a very comfortable situation. There are situations where maybe that's good enough. If the signal on top of the mountain only had to be 1 watt, and you're willing to put 100 watts of power into the cable to get it there, and therefore you can tolerate 20 decibels of loss, that's 100-to-1 ratio, you could have a workable system. But when you start getting to those small percentages of operation, there's a much more tempting way to go, and that is to periscope antenna system, or a so-called fly swatter, or a passive reflector. There's a company called Microflect. I think they're in the, I think they're way out there in Washington. Is it Washington? Yeah, Washington State. They sell a whole bunch of stuff that will allow you to put hardware on top of the mountain, and passively you can send a signal with a dish up to the passive reflector on top of the mountain, reflect it from there to the signal back down into the valley, so to speak, and get very good coverage. In other words, the air-type waveguide, that's what a periscope antenna system really is. You have air-type waveguide. It can have a hell of a lot less loss than real waveguide or real coaxial cable. Let's see, I'm going to be able to copy you on 975-375, John, even though you and I might not be coming through the 85 repeater right now. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, very good. So in other words, you can make an RF transmission from the shack with this fly swatter system to the tower and then do what you want up there. Is that basically the reason?
That in turn would give you a nice strong signal And the periscope antenna system, properly used, a periscope antenna system can have not only a lack of loss, in other words, a piece of the best kind of waveguide you can use, to give a good example, on 10 gigs, is a WR90 waveguide. It's 9/10 of an inch wide. It's as wide as you can go without getting into the next higher mode. So 9/10 of an inch guide waveguide at 10 gigs has 4.5 dB of loss per 100 feet. If it's brand new, silver plated, dry nitrogen filled, that's the best you can do with transmission line. If you instead send the signal by way of a coax cable going either to your dish at the base of the tower, the dish is aimed straight up parallel to the tower to a 45-degree flight swatter on the top of the tower. That's a so-called periscope antenna system. And now that periscope antenna system deflects the signal out to the horizon. That system can have 0.5 dB, maybe as much as 1 dB of gain in signal strength that you transmit, as opposed to 4.5 dB of loss if you use the waveguide. So using the air space between the dish on the bottom of the ground at the base of the tower and the 45-degree slice water, at the so-called periscope antenna system, you can actually get a small amount of gain. You can get a small amount of gain out of that system compared to free space. In other words, if you had the transmitter right on the dish and the dish was at the top of the tower, you compare that signal strength compared to a well-designed fly swatter system. The fly swatter system with the dish on the ground, the transmitter on the ground, and let's say 100 feet of tower, you can end up with 0.5 dB, maybe as much as 1 dB of gain, extra signal strength. Where's the extra signal strength that was coming from? I'm talking about signal strength gain compared to the dish on top of the tower. When you compare it to 4.5 dB per 100 feet of waveguide loss, you come out even further ahead, if you can tell what I mean. So the periscope antenna systems were very popular 20, 30 years ago. The only thing wrong with them is that in those days, the frequencies they were using for the transmission of the microwave signals for telephone circuits happened to be the exact same frequencies that were being used by satellites. So the dish on the ground aimed straight up would also be simultaneously hitting a satellite that goes by. And that's the only reason why those systems became less popular. KC2WGB, I'll hear you on either mode. K2LRW in the tech map.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Yeah, I'm hearing you very well. I know you keep stopping, but you're coming through no problem at all. So, alrighty. So we got that solved for him. But his question, I believe what he was trying to say is, in a waveguide, there's no center conductor, so why are they concerned about skin effect? But he does know that they do plate the sides of some of these waveguides and didn't understand the application of skin effects that there was no, when there's no center conductor, so to speak.
Hey, you got it exactly right, John. Yes, there is no center conductor. And even though there's no center conductor, the signal on really low frequencies compared to the microwave type frequencies, 2 meters, 6 meters, 80 meters, we tend to use either twin leader coax cable, and there is a real center conductor there, because trying to set up a piece of waveguide a half wavelength wide, where a half wavelength on 80 meters is 132 feet, very few of us are going to build a piece of waveguide 132 feet wide. So a coax cable does the job. When you get up to a high enough frequency where you can make the waveguide half wavelength wide between the two narrow walls, now you don't need the center conductor anymore. The signal goes down the waveguide. Good common sense would lead you to believe it goes down the center of the guide just like your eyesight does. Absolutely not. The signal goes down there by bouncing back and forth in a zigzag manner between the left narrow wall and the right narrow wall. It bounces back and forth at a 30 or so degree angle, depending on frequency and size of waveguide. And it's got a lot lower loss than coax cable would have at that frequency. And as I said, lower loss, and it's got this crazy bounce characteristic. As such, the bounce angle changes as a function of frequency and a function of the size of the waveguide. The bottom line of that is that waveguide, when you use a lot of it, has another crazy characteristic called dispersion. If you're transmitting a broadband signal, like for instance a television signal, at 6 megacycles wide, the higher frequency, 6 megacycles above the lower frequency, has a slightly different balance angle. Therefore, it gets there in a slightly different period of time. So you get a little bit of time shift versus frequency. And so there's this crazy characteristic called group delay distortion that waveguide has got. There's ways around it. You can pre-distort your signal to get a, to compensate for it. But so once again, with coax cables, you don't need the center conductor, but you're still using the conductivity of those walls. For that signal to bounce off those walls efficiently, the walls have got to have high conductivity. Because of skin effect, the RF energy is only penetrating less than 10,000ths of an inch into those walls. Therefore, not all of that copper that's there is doing you any good. And the real resistance is a little higher than you think. And therefore, there's a little bit more loss than you think. It is the resistance of the copper walls that gives you the loss of the waveguide. It's got nothing to do with what the waveguide is filled with. It's the conductivity of the walls. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, I'm sure you can understand that. So when they put a little gold plating on there, it's very thin because it doesn't penetrate that much, but it is more efficient transfer because the loss is less. I assume that follows logic, does it not?
Good guess, John, but not quite. In the case of putting gold on connectors, where you want the male and female connector coming together to make very good contact, you use gold because it doesn't give you copper oxide. However, almost nobody will cover the inside of waveguide with gold. Almost nobody will cover the center conductor of their coax cable for the whole length with gold, because gold has more resistance than copper, even with copper oxide on the surface. And the copper oxide is a kind of insulator. If you cover it with silver, silver has got a little bit higher conductivity, and the silver oxide is also, or silver sulfate, is a little bit more conductive than would copper oxide be. And the copper oxide is not as bad as you think. It may look ugly to your eye, but the actual thickness of the copper oxide on the surface is a couple of millionths of an inch. The RF energy goes through that insulated layer, goes down to the real meat of the copper that sees down below, and does its thing. So when you silver plate, you're doing it for conductivity. When you gold plate, you're doing it because you've got mating connectors, male and female contacts coming together. But the long length of the coax cable or the long length of the waveguide, almost nobody did that, unless they're just doing it for some kind of attractive appearance. But radio performance-wise, it wouldn't give you an improvement. When it comes to very high-Q coaxial cavities, reentrant cavities, waveguide cavities, they silver plate those. They never gold plate them, per se. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay, Dick. Sufficient explanation there. I'm sure he has a good idea of what's going on. Interesting. I've seen some small pictures of waveguide. I don't know if it was 90 or 46, but it was gold plated on the inside. Those items were only like maybe 8 inches long. I don't know what they were used for, but it may have been something special. They were gold plated. They looked beautiful, but on the inside, so who the hell sees it? Let me go to the next one. Let me let drop.
You got it, Sean. K2LIW.
KQRIW, this is KC2WTV. Dick, it did not look like gold plating. Have you ever experienced gold flashing like they do with lenses for telescopes when they illuminate?
When they gold plate a lens on a telescope, the usual reason for doing that, John, is that gold has a lot more reflectivity of an infrared signal. So if your telescope is going to be used for infrared reception, then to gold plate the surface instead of silver plate the surface is used. Gold looks gold, which means it reflects red light better than blue light. That's why it's got that goldish color to it. And so the infrared you're looking for is in that direction, if you know what I mean. I have seen parabolic lenses, and I've seen other kinds of corner reflector lenses that were gold plated for optical purposes. That's because it was an infrared detecting system. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
Oh, yeah, 100% right. I've also had some prisms that were gold. But that isn't plated. That's flashed in a vacuum. I don't know if you've ever seen that process. But that, when you grind your lens, you send it out to have it silvered, but not silvered, it's actually aluminum. That's aluminum flashed, and they do the same thing with the gold. It's a flash deposition.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, John, because the parabolic surface, for optical purposes, you are adjusting it to the nearest millionth of an inch, so to speak. A wavelength of optical blue-green, yellow-green, the middle of the optical band, is 550 nanometers. That's what is that now? Roughly half a millionth of a meter, 550 nanometers. And you'd like to have a 20th of a wavelength of accuracy. So yes, it would be an extremely thin layer of gold or silver or whatever aluminum you put on there, because you don't want to have to re-grind the mirror because of the variation of the thickness of the stuff you put on there. That's why it's a very precise flashing, as you said, not really gold plating. But I could call it gold plating, but you're absolutely right. Flashing is a much better word for it. KC2WGV, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, let me go on to the next one. There you go. WGB and the TechNet. Experiment set up on this test. I think I might run this experiment myself. He has a 3-watt transmitter. He's got a wave meter, which we now call a frequency meter, but this is an antique. He's got a signal strength meter. Distance of, 2 meters. Okay, the signal strength meter, the RF signal strength meter, is 2 meters away from the transmitter. It's receiving 6 microvolts. He has a wave meter, approximately 1 meter, in between the two, but offset by 10 degrees. You have that construct?
I do, and the word wave meter, by the way, usually is a device that's put in the middle of a transmission line. You seem to be describing this as a object in free space between the transmitter and a receiving antenna. So I'm a little bit confused by that so-called wave meter. But back to you, John.
Well, it's called a wave meter because it's labeled wave meter on this device. But it's really an absorption meter. Do you remember those? Usually for a very narrow range. His is between 200 and 300 megahertz.
Okay, but the absorption type wave meters usually are in a transmission line, and it's a small cavity off to one side with a very light coupling to the transmission line, whether it be waveguide or coax. And when you do a swept frequency measurement on an oscilloscope with a sweeping signal generator, it gives you a little bit of a tick. A marker on the screen, if you know what I mean. That's the way a frequency meter, wave meter type is used. As a free space object, I guess this thing you call wave meter is something which has got a highly tuned resonator to it with some kind of a small antenna to it, is what I think you're describing. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
That's correct, Dave. It has an antenna that plugs into the top of the panel, and it's extendable, goes up about maybe 2 feet. And it has a very large dial, about maybe 8 inches in diameter, with the markings on it. And as you tune through it, you can see the meter move at the frequency. It'll tell you exactly what the frequency is if you interpolate from the dial on the meter.
Yeah, when you get a chance, John, I'd like you to mail me a picture of one of those things. I can see the theory of operation. I get some feeling for how it can work. I don't think I've ever really seen one. But go right ahead. I'm getting the picture, so go right ahead with the rest of your description and the question itself. You got it, John.
At 2 microvolt drop on the signal strength meter, he wants to know what's going on.
Okay, give that to me again now. A 2 microvolt drop in the signal strength when he operates the wave meter, is that what you're saying? The wave meter creates a 2 microvolts drop. I think you said he had 6 microvolts. And is the wave meter operation or the location of the wave meter that's creating the 2 microvolts drop? Or run that by again, John. K2LAW.
Okay, the transmitter. Your device. Distance. Is 1 meter away, 10 degrees. So if you have the transmitter to the of the signal meter, the signal strength meter, by 10 between the two.
Yes, I think I've got that, John, so go right ahead with the rest of the description.
Okay, when he tunes the wave meter to exact resonance so that his gets an indication on his meter, he notices the 6 millivolts down to 4 millivolts on the signal strength meter. And he doesn't understand why. It has nothing to do with body capacitance because it happens no matter how he tunes the wave meter. But if he puts the wave meter in a different position before the transmitter, which would be, if you were looking at it on a bench, it would be to the left of the transmitter, there's no effect at all. So he wants to know what's going on.
Okay, I think I've got some guesses, John. The wave meter itself is a tuned circuit. That tuned circuit has an antenna connected to it, and depending on whether you adjust the tuned circuit slightly above resonance, right on resonance, or below resonance, makes a huge difference in what happens when it comes to radar cross-section. The transmit signal being transmitted from that antenna, some of it is going straight to the receiving antenna, some of it's going to the wave meter, and after it reflects off of the wave meter, you think it's a purely absorption device. Well, every dipole-like antenna absorbs a certain amount of signal and re-radiates a significant percentage of that signal. Your 80-meter dipole, you would think any 80-meter signal, all of it gets picked up by the antenna and goes down the transmission line. Of the signal picked up by your 80-meter dipole, a certain percentage of it is re-radiated back in space. You can't stop that from happening. The antenna is going to do that. Every antenna doesn't absorb 100% of what hits it. It re-radiates it in space. Well, depending on the tuning of the antenna connected to the wave meter, that signal reflected off of it is in phase, out of phase, leading in phase, lagging in phase, and so on. So depending on the geometry and the reflection off of the wave meter antenna, the signal we're getting to the receiving antenna can be co-phase, anti-phase, or something in between. So that's part of what I think is going on here, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW, check that.
This is interesting. I was thinking of studying this myself. Now, he didn't tell me when he puts it behind the transmitting antenna, displacement on the meter, and it will tune. There's
8 meter behind the transmitting antenna. Assuming the transmitting antenna has some kind of a reasonable front to back ratio, the total amount of signal getting to the wave meter is now so small, and the amount that's reflected off of it going forward toward the receiving antenna has a greater distance to go. So because of inverse square law of the greater distance, because of the front to back ratio of the transmitting antenna, the total amount of signal getting to the wave meter when it's behind the transmitting antenna is drastically decreased. Now, although there's enough signal there on the one-way path from the transmitter signal, finite front-to-back ratio, and the receive and the wave meter itself, the wave meter is still responding. It's getting enough signal to respond, but the total amount of signal it's getting and re-reflecting forward through the extra distance is such that now the receiving antenna sees. See very, very minor differences. You'd be able to measure the presence of the wave meter. However, I think that difference would be very small. Because of this geometry,
thank you. the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Code number 916 on the New England reflector.
Yeah, I don't hear anything on the input, Rockaway at all. Nothing.
Pearl Valley N2EO, nothing here in Whitestone. Good evening from N2EO.
Like 0.047s, 0.1s,
.001s. He wants to make something that he could have a go-no-go gauge or a system. What do you recommend he could do with that type of equipment? Over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
That's a darn good question. And it displays a very basic piece of information about the way a capacitor behaves. The Hewlett-Packard, not Hewlett-Packard, the vacuum tube voltmeter, the V7 vacuum tube voltmeter made by Heathkit, was a very popular meter way back in the 1950s time frame. And there was a beautiful article that appeared in Popular Electronics. And what the article had you do was to take, and by the way, that vacuum tube voltmeter literally had vacuum tubes, 6S and 7, as I remember, was the dual triode that really operated the darn 60 microvolt, 60 microampere meter movement. By taking the filament winding of that transformer, 6.3 volts AC, and bringing it out to a terminal on the side of the unit, the two terminals where you put an unknown capacitor, the capacitor in turn went, the second terminal went to the AC input terminal. When the meter was used in the 60s, when the meter was used in the AC voltage measurement range, the meter movement itself had, I'm not sure what the number was, 1,000 ohm or 10,000 ohms of impedance input. And by measuring the amount of 6.3 volts that went through your capacitor into the meter movement, into the voltmeter, AC voltmeter reading, you have this scale on the side where you could read as small as around 10 picofarads and as high as around 1 microfarad. But let me backtrack and tell you what's really going on here, the bottom line of this. Everybody knows that the formula for capacitor reactants, should know if you pass the test, is 1 over 2 pi square root of LC. Now that's the resonant frequency. 1 over 2 pi FC, yes, 1 over 2 pi, where you plug in frequency in hertz and the capacitant in farads, and you solve that formula that gives you the capacitor reactance. Let's assume now that I want to test a 0.1 microfarad capacitor. Using that formula, and I choose some particular convenient frequency, maybe the answer is 100 hertz, maybe it's 1 kc, maybe it's 10 kc. But you plug in the right frequency with that known number of microfarads or farads. By solving that formula, you'll calculate the capacitor reactance. Or you can look it up in the chart in the first couple of chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook. So one way or another, when you know the microfarads and you know the frequency, you know the capacitor reactance. Let's assume that you've chosen the right combination of capacitor and frequency, so that the capacitor reactance is, let me pick a number, 1,000 ohms. That would be a very handy number. If the capacitor reactance is 1,000 ohms, and now you set up a an L network, in other words, one terminal of the input capacitor, you call it the main input terminal, the other capacitor terminal goes to the resistor, the bottom where the resistor goes to ground. Now, when you take your AC voltmeter, assuming the AC voltmeter has got a very high impedance and that's disturbing the circuit, and now across that L network of capacitor and resistor to ground, you put your signal generator. Maybe it's 1,000 hertz. When the capacitor reactance and the resistance equals each other, the voltmeter...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
When the capacitor reactance and the resistance equal each other, the voltage drop across the capacitor and the voltage drop across the the resistor will be the same. Even though there's a phase shift across them, the voltage drop will be the same. So if you've got a very high impedance AC voltmeter, and modern day digital voltmeters all have a 10 mega ohm input impedance, so compared to a 1,000 ohm resistance that you're measuring, 10 mega ohms in parallel with it is 0.001% change, nothing. Don't worry about it. So you put your digital voltmeter first across the 1K resistor in my example, then you put it across the capacitor, and if the two voltages equal each other, then the capacitor reactance and the resistance equals each other, and you've confirmed the capacitance. So here's one way you could do it. You could flip back and forth on your digital voltmeter between measuring the voltage drop across the capacitor, measuring the voltage drop across the resistor, and swishing the frequency out of the audio signal generator until the two equal each other. Once you know the resistance of your resistor, 1K ohm in my example, once you know the frequency out of your signal generator, your audio signal generator, you plug that frequency into the formula, and you'll confirm exactly how many microfarads is that capacitor. So the real clue to all of this is make the two voltages equal. You don't have to. You could have them unequal, but now it's a little bit more complicated calculation, if you know what I mean. But knowing the amount, what you're literally measuring with that circuit is you're measuring the amount of capacitor reactance. Once you know that capacitor reactance and your operating frequency, you know the microfarads. Wonder if that makes some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, Dick, yeah, that's very simple and very, very succinct to this area. He can do a lot with that. So he's actually, he's got a nice VTVM. He's got an HP400, which is a nice little VTVM, kind of old, but they work well. And the audio generator, he's got exactly what he needs to perform a lot of tests like that for capacitors. And he could quickly make a go-no-go gauge by just taking his point ones and substituting them one at a time and make sure their voltage stays the same. Then he can confirm which ones are exactly matched and not. So, wow, that's perfect. Very good, Dick.
There's a little bit of a catch here, John, and that is if he was doing this with a modern-day digital voltmeter, the digital voltmeter has got a plastic case, your ground lead and your hot lead, the black and the red lead coming out of that, a thoroughly floating voltmeter running on its own internal 9-volt battery. That's a completely floating meter. You can put it across anything you want, and it'll measure the voltage drop between the two probes rather accurately. That's the good news. A Hewlett-Packard 400 AC voltmeter, I'm not sure whether or not there is a mode of operation where the two input terminals, a GR connector, I think is what it had in the old days, whether or not that thoroughly floats. I'm worried about the fact that the case of the AC voltmeter may be grounded by way of the third prong that goes into the wall, and the case may be directly connected to one of the leads. So if the case of the meter is grounded, now you have no trouble measuring the voltage drop across the resistor going to ground. But now measuring the voltage drop across the capacitor represents a problem because it's a floating voltage supply, if you know what I mean. However, there's a way around that. Even if the meter has a grounded lead, what you could do is first measure the voltage drop across the resistor and record it. Then he flips around. Let me drop. He flips around the location of the resistor and the capacitor. He now makes the capacitor go to ground, and the resistor is the floating thing going up to the signal generator. And now he measures the voltage drop across the capacitor. So you have to recognize the fact that some AC voltmeters, particularly the old-fashioned AC VTVM, the negative lead coming out of the case is connected to the case on many of them. It's not floating. So you have to worry about making a floating voltage measurement on a partially grounded instrument. So by flipping the location of the two, you can get around that. That's one approach. The other approach is always make all voltage measurements with reference to ground. First measure the voltage coming out of your signal generator, then measure the voltage drop across the resistor. A little bit more complicated calculation is required because of the phase shifting characteristic, but still there's a way around it. So you've got to be a little bit careful with the floating versus grounded voltmeter. See where I'm going on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely, Dick. When I do that and I run into that problem, I use an isolation transformer on the case. That is a grounded case on that, and the probe is grounded to the case. So, yeah, if you use an isolation transformer, that'll eliminate that problem.
Yes and no. There's a catch on that one, John. The isolation transformer gives you beautiful isolation at 60 hertz. And if you're operating at 1 kilocycle, coming out of the signal generator, no sweat. If you're operating at 1 megacycle coming out of the signal generator, and you might when you're measuring a 10 picofarad capacitor, now at 1 megacycle, that so-called isolation transformer has a significant amount of capacitance compared to 1 megacycle or 10 megacycle. The capacitance between the primary and the secondary could make life a little bit difficult. You go to a high enough frequency, and that isolation transformer is not isolating anymore. The capacitive reactance between primary and secondary means that RF1